Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict urges world political leaders to recognise the importance of religions within the social fabric of every society and ensure their policies support and uphold the common good. Slamming the door shut. Real people, real needs is the theme for this year's World Refugee Day being marked this week. But how often is this fact forgotten amidst the rising anti-immigrant rhetoric heard in many Western nations? And Congo methods of war. We find out how Catholic aid organisations are helping communities whose lives have been devastated by the conflict in the DR Congo, including women who have undergone the trauma of rape. Benedict has urged world political leaders to recognise the importance of religions within the social fabric of every society and ensure that their policies support and uphold the common good. He was speaking at his Wednesday general audience. Emma McCarthy reports.
Over 30,000 pilgrims were present in St. Peter's Square, among them groups from Malaysia and Singapore, unusual additions to this papal appointment. Pope Benedict also recalled the meeting of religious leaders from around the world, currently underway here in Rome ahead of the July G8 summit.
I'm confident that it will do much to draw the attention of world political leaders to the importance of religions within the social fabric of every society, and to the grave duty to ensure that their deliberations and policies support and uphold the common good.
But the Pope's real lesson for pilgrims this Wednesday is that enculturalization is no modern phenomenon, and that the gospel message can only really be understood if it is accessible to people in their own language. All this from his reflections on two brothers from 9th century Greece, who became known as the Apostles of the Slavs and co-patrons of Europe, Saints Cyril and Methodius.
They were born in Thessalonica in the early 9th century.
Cyril was the younger of the two and was sent to Constantinople at 14 years of age, where he was a companion of Emperor Manuel III.
When his brother Michael became a monk, taking the name of Methodius, Cyril also decided to embrace the monastic life.
Their mission began when both brothers were invited to the Crimea, where Cyril added Hebrew to his list of languages and found the tomb and relics of Pope Clement I, who had been exiled there. They were then invited to Moravia, the modern-day Czech Republic and Slovakia, by Michael III at the behest of Prince Radislav, who said, "We have no master who can teach us about our faith in our own language." It was at this point that Cyril began translating the gospel into Slav. In 1867, they were called to Rome, where despite hostility from Latin and Greek traditionalists, Pope Hadrian II welcomed them, recognizing the importance of their ecclesial mission.
Inventing an alphabet for the Slavonic language, they together with their disciples translated the liturgy, the Bible, and texts of the fathers, shaping the culture of the Slav peoples and living an outstanding example of enculturation.
May we imitate their strong faith and their Christian wisdom, concluded Pope Benedict, as we bear witness to the gospel in our daily lives. I'm Ira McCarthy.
Real people, real needs is the theme chosen for World Refugee Day being celebrated this week. But how often is this fact forgotten amidst the anti-immigrant rhetoric increasingly heard in a number of Western nations, including here in Italy? A new report issued by the UNHCR shows that the number of people forcibly uprooted by conflict and persecution worldwide stood at 42 million at the end of 2008. The total includes 16 million refugees and asylum seekers and 26 million internally displaced people uprooted within their own countries. According to the UNHCR report, 80% of the world's refugees are in developing nations, underscoring the disproportionate burden carried by those least able to afford it. But in the wealthy West, fear and mistrust of undocumented migrants and immigrants appears to be rising, and many say this phenomenon is being exacerbated by the global economic crisis. In a statement marking World Refugee Day, the Jesuit Refugee Services, or JRS, said it is extremely worrying that the world's richest states continue to shirk their responsibilities with regard to refugees. JRS said instead of welcoming people forced by extreme poverty and violence to flee their homes, these nations are slamming the door shut. The JRS strongly criticised the recent agreement between Italy and Libya, under which migrants intercepted at sea en route to Italy are forcibly returned to Libya without any attempt to determine whether or not they are in need of protection. Jane Stapleton is the International Communications Coordinator at JRS, and he told me why the theme for this year's World Refugee Day is particularly apt.
The theme for this year's World Refugee Day is real people, real needs. How apt is this choice? Do you think there is now a tendency for people not to consider the refugee or migrant as a real person and just as somebody to be feared, as a part of an army of people who are trying to get in?
I think, unfortunately, that's the case. We often hear about the large numbers that are waiting in countries to come to European countries and to North America. We hear about how many people die trying to come over. 13,000 people have died in the last 15 years trying to cross the Mediterranean. And what we'd like to do is to use the 20th of June as an opportunity to say to people, well, hold on one moment. Yes, there are large numbers of people in need of international protection, but 80% of them are living in developing countries. And we're concerned that developed countries are taking steps to prevent people from arriving to protection when protection is not available in the countries that they're fleeing from. The most obvious example, we're here in Italy at the moment, the most obvious example in recent weeks has been the Italian government's decision to send people back to Libya, a country which hasn't signed the Geneva Convention and that is known to hold people in indefinite detention where they experience serious human rights abuses.
In fact, the Italian government has said that this new policy of returning the migrants to Libya, intercepting them at sea and forcibly sending them, should be adopted as the new model for dealing with illegal immigration and be extended to the rest of Europe. I mean, are you frightened that countries might do that, other countries?
We are concerned, and Italy isn't the first country that's adopting what we would describe as practices which are not in line with their international commitments to protect human rights. The Italian government has often stated that refugees and asylum seekers will be protected, but migrants need to be returned. Now, it's true that governments like the Italian and other European governments have a right to protect their borders, to manage migration in and out of their countries. But we in the Refugee Service and many other refugee organisations throughout the world cannot understand how people can be protected if the government will send them back to countries like Libya without even asking the question, why are you trying to get into Italy? Many of them move for reasons related to economic pressure in their countries of origin, and we don't expect European countries to take all of the people who arrive in, but what we do expect them to take is to accept people who are fleeing persecution and serious human rights abuses.
As we heard there from James, the JRS is particularly concerned about the recent deal reached between the governments of Italy and Libya concerning the return to Tripoli of migrants intercepted at sea. But how do Italians themselves feel about the issue of migrants? And what is the likely impact in the long term of this new immigration policy adopted by the Rome government? To find out more from the Italian angle, I also spoke to Chiara Peri, project manager for JRS in Italy.
We are very worried. We have expressed several times our worry about this policy, which do not take into consideration the obligation of respecting human rights, and in particular, the obligation that any state, including Italy, has to verify if the person who is sent back is safe in the place where is sent back, and if he or she is in need of international protection, because in this case it is absolutely explicit in the Convention of Geneva that it is not possible, return is not possible, because one basic principle of the convention itself is the principle of non-refoulement, which is exactly non-return. If someone is in need of protection, he has to be given the possibility of applying for asylum in the place where he or she is. This is absolutely not the case when a boat is intercepted in the sea, as it happened last May, and all the people are sent to a third country, in this case Libya, without even trying to identify if they are in need of protection. In this particular case, we are absolutely sure that the people who have been sent back were asylum seekers, because we know that they came from Somalia, they came from Horn of Africa. So in fact, they were absolutely in the typology of people who has to be to receive protection.
Human rights groups claim that Libya has a record of treating badly migrants who are returned to its shores. Is this borne out by what you hear from the refugees themselves that you come into contact with? What do they say about conditions in Libya?
Condition in Libya is well known because of direct witness of many, many migrants here in Italy, but also in Malta and also wherever they arrive. They talk about horrible condition in detention. This witnesses was enforced by visits of International Commission to Libya. The condition of detention are absolutely unbearable from any respect.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, for example, 80%, more or less 80% of women who arrived from Libya have been raped, for example. People are detained without any jurisdiction, any process, any validation from juridical point of view. And there are many, many cases of corruption and of people beaten by police force who are also connected to the smugglers. We have plenty of witnesses like this.
Of these people then that are returned to Libya, do they eventually get expelled to a third country or do they stay there in detention in Libya?
It is very, very probable that they are sent back because we have also some news about that, and also because detention centers in Libya, of course, are overcrowded but cannot just put people in and not out. We don't know exactly, unfortunately, because no one is entitled to have precise information about that. But what we know is that Libya has no obligations, in the sense that Libya has not signed the Geneva Convention for Refugees, and Libya has policy of not respecting human rights. And the recent declaration of Colonel Gheddafi not respecting human rights, and the recent declaration of Colonel Gheddafi in Italy are a clear proof of that. He says that there are no asylum seekers in Africa, that all African people are just people living in the forest, and when they feel the smell of the money, they come back, otherwise they don't come. And he even said, do you want me to send you more? So it's clear that he is using these people for his economic interests in particular.
What do the refugees, the migrants that you come into contact with here in Italy, what do they say about this new policy and these generally strong anti-immigrant rhetoric?
Well, one thing to say is that if the hope of the government is to prevent people to come, this is absolutely impossible, because people know that it is more difficult, but nevertheless, they are forced to leave, so they come. And the only thing that you obtain is to make things even more difficult and more dangerous for the most vulnerable people that cross the Mediterranean Sea. What is also clear that the general climate in Europe is also very worrying, and so migrants feel this strong xenophobia rising, which is encouraged by this kind of policy of the government, because if the government is not respecting persons as human beings, so any citizen somehow is encouraged in his xenophobic attitude. So this policy of the government of stressing on public security and treating all migrants in a block like they were as criminals, a direct threat, is clearly unfounded. It's based on facts that does not exist. And so the government is stressing this very much to show that they are doing something precise and something that people somehow now expect from them.
What do the migrants themselves report about how they're treated by Italians here?
Well, this, of course, depends very much on their own experience, because it's clear that in general we meet mostly asylum seekers and refugees, and sometimes they were expecting a lot from Italy, from Europe in general, because they consider that a symbol of democracy or what they don't have in their own countries. And unfortunately, sometimes they are very disappointed in these expectations, because sometimes they are treated very unjustly and in a way that they don't understand.
But there is this perception among the public that they're all just economic migrants seeking a better life. But that's not really the case, is it?
Yes, this is not the case. And this is the result of the fact that in Italy there is a big ignorance about asylum as a theme in general. So mostly they don't know. They don't have a specific prejudice against asylum seekers. They just put it all together with migrants in general. So one important thing, for example, that we as GRS Italy, we are trying to do since 2000, more or less, are exactly projects in high schools, just to bring students to meet directly refugees and to listen to their experience and to know that there is a category which is forced migrants that is not exactly the same that economic migrants, and that some people just can choose. They just here because they had to flee, full stop. I think it's very important to create a sensibility on this theme, but of course the general climate in this moment doesn't encourage at all, because when you have a prime minister saying that it's one out of 1,000 who is in need of protection, absolutely contradicting the data from the Ministry of the Interior, by the way. So there is not much you can do against this.
Do you believe that, in fact, in the wake of this deal between Italy and Libya, for instance, on this forcible return of migrants intercepted at sea, that what these people will do is simply avoid going via Libya and choose another route to come?
Yes, of course they will. And for the moment, as far as we know, they are moving the place on along the coast of Libya in a farthest place because they know that some harbors are more controlled than others, and then probably in the future another route will be used. The point is that the new routes are longer, more dangerous, and far more expensive. So somehow what you are doing is making smugglers richer.
But, I mean, come what may, these people are going to carry on coming, no matter what obstacles are placed in their path.
Of course. I mean, if you are from Somalia, you cannot avoid going away. And we all know what is happening, and not from yesterday, in Somalia or in Ethiopia or in Eritrea. So it's useless to think that just because it's more difficult, these people are going to stay home. Nobody will.
Viva l'Italia, l'Italia che non ha paura.
But let's go back to James now and hear more about his point of view on Italy's current situation and take a look at other issues affecting the debate over immigration in the wider international community.
Now, Pope Benedict and the Catholic Church in general have expressed concern at the rising anti-immigrant rhetoric that we've been hearing of late in Italy. Why do you think Italians, or perhaps should I say here the government, are so frightened or feel so threatened by these migrants?
I think the presence of a number of the political parties in government, particularly the Northern League, is not helping the situation, as they use violent rhetoric to portray what is the normal movement of people, which has always taken place throughout the world, with violent crimes. We in the Jesuit Refugee Service are very clear. Where people commit crimes, they should be punished. But the whole categories of people shouldn't be criminalised. We understand that in Italy at the moment, and as in Europe, there's an economic crisis. But we would ask people to think about the reasons why people are coming to their countries and think about the benefits that they bring when they arrive. Most European countries couldn't survive without the migrants that have come in and are doing the jobs that Europeans either do not want to do or are unable to do. So we should think about the whole situation. First, we should think about the relatively small numbers of migrants, and particularly refugees who are moving into Europe in comparison with the rest of the world. At a conservative estimate, there are 40 million forcibly displaced people throughout the world. A very small number of them get to Europe. But it's extremely important that countries in Europe and the United States welcome people in. Because if Europe and the United States begin to close their doors, this is a message that they're sending to the rest of the world, who accept much, much larger numbers. The result of this will be greater political instability and greater suffering. And it will do absolutely nothing to address the causes why people are moving, which is the second thing that governments really need to do. We really need to start to address the causes of economic marginalization and human rights abuses throughout the rest of the world if we really want to stop people from moving.
Do you think perhaps, you know, this economic crisis, this global economic crisis, is certainly not helping people welcome immigrants and is indeed feeding that fear?
I think what's feeding the fear is the insecurity that people face in their own economic lives. Government propaganda, which is unhelpful and simplistic, combined with certain elements of the media who feel that it's easier to report on the 5% of people who arrive into countries like Italy via boat from Libya, rather than the 95% of people who come in with visas.
Perhaps it's also not very well known that, in fact, though we talk so much about the flow of legal immigrants into Western countries, that, in fact, 80% of the displaced people, the migrants, the refugees, the asylum seekers, are actually located in other developing countries, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, the vast majority of forcibly displaced peoples in the world are in the countries, either in their own countries, for example, in Colombia or in Sudan, where between the two of them are there anything up to 9 million people who are displaced within these countries. And then, obviously, in the neighbouring countries, take Latin America once again as an example, where there are 1 million Colombians who live in the border states. But I'd just like to focus for one second on the Ecuadorian situation. Recently, the Ecuadorian government has said, instead of adopting a negative policy towards the large number of people who are in their country, they've actually started a process of the regularization of people who are in need of international protection in their country. They're talking about regularizing 35,000 Colombians living in Ecuador. This is the sort of approach that we would like to see European countries take. Integrating people into their societies, giving them the training so they can contribute, and it doesn't cost us what we feel it will cost us, either economically or socially.
I was speaking to James Stapleton and earlier to Chiara Perry of Jesuit Refugee Services.
Viva l'Italia! L'Italia che non muore! Viva l'Italia! Presa a tradimento!
In the DR Congo, the scale of the humanitarian catastrophe is so vast that it's difficult to grasp the full enormity of the suffering endured by the civilian population as a result of more than a decade of conflict. The UN estimates 5.4 million people have been killed, either directly or indirectly, due to this catastrophe. It has warned that rapes, lootings and killings by the army and rebels are on the rise in eastern Congo. Earlier this week, perhaps some of you heard the news about how a 3-year-old girl died on her way to hospital after being raped by a rebel fighter in Congo's South Kivu region. Three of the tiny victim's sisters, aged 12, 14 and 17, were also raped by the rebels. As a UN spokeswoman pointed out, this incident is emblematic of the barbarity and the horror which is taking place in the conflict zone of eastern Congo. Pascal Palmer is the Advocacy Media Officer for the Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD, based in London. She's just returned from a visit to two projects funded by CAFOD and Caritas Internationalis in the eastern Congo and spoke to my colleague John Kelly about these projects.
What happens is you end up with groups of people who are completely emotionally and community-wise destroyed through the action of rape. A lot of these women that I met had children through rape, and them themselves dealing with that on top of sometimes being abandoned by their families because of being blamed for being raped. Some of these women living with the memory of not just one individual rape, but maybe being held by rebel militias for 5, 6, 7 months and being used as sexual partners throughout that time, and then having to make their way back into the community, back into trying to make something of their lives for themselves and for their children. And one of the projects that CAFOD and Caritas have been working on over the last few months that we think is really important is this thing called listening rooms. And it's where women who have had the psychological trauma of being raped as a weapon of war have a chance to be together, have a chance to share their stories, and at the same time the chance to learn a skill which hopefully is a catharsis in itself, along with the talking, along with the community of being with others who've understood their experience. And when they're strong enough to move away from that community, being able to have a skill that can earn them some money. So in Goma, I saw a group of 15 women who come together periodically to talk about what's going on in their lives, to share their stories of having been held, having been raped, and the power of being within that group of women, where they told me stories of their husbands accusing them of being to blame for being raped, their families abandoning them, them having nothing. And Caritas and CAFOD have welcomed them into this project and given them the chance to realize it's not their fault, with the other women talking about the issues and sharing those stories and making sure that they can then, as whole people, move forward and rebuild those lives. It's incredibly life-affirming to hear the stories of these women who'd been through such terrible things and yet were so strong.
These listening rooms, have they been very successful? Are there any stories of that? Because we do hear, like, most of the stories we get back here are to do with, like, the horrific stories of, like, a 3-year-old girl who was raped last week and things like that. And I was just wondering how effective these are. It sounds like they're a great idea, but I was just wondering what your experience of them is.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I heard so many horrendous stories, to use your word, from my visit to DRC, even from not just the women, but people who were working for Caritas in the Ituri district. I visited a place called Mongbualu, where we're working with this cadre de consultation, which is the group who are trying to get the voice of the community and civil society to be heard by a big gold mining company there. And in that area, one of the people who was working with Caritas was taking a group of sick people in a van. One of their projects is to help facilitate people's movements to and from hospital. And he himself was ambushed by rebels and cut with a machete. And so you're hearing these terrible stories all the time. But in relation to the rape stories, it is a massive problem. It's on a scale that almost one's mind can't get around, because it's being used. It's not a pastime. It actually is a method of warfare. And so women are being used as a way to damage a community, because people understand that it means that those women give birth to children that sometimes are rejected by their own community, and the women themselves are rejected by their community. And we will see the long-term effects soon of things like the listening room, but that has been set up with the money that CAFOD supporters pledged and gave only at the end of last year. So we're only a few months in, but from what I could see, I saw women with hope, and from what they've said to me before being part of the listening rooms, they said that they didn't have hope.
Pascal Palmer of CAFOD, speaking to my colleague, John Kelly. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.